Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. This is Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare, science, and politics in the news, around all of the above, and your questions, comments, emails, and calls, all in the next hour on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I want to start out with just an appeal, actually. A little background first. I'm asking you to help by writing to your congressperson, especially my podcast listeners, who I know are distributed all over the country. We really need to do something about this Medicare payment problem that Congress created, quite a long time ago now, about 10 years ago. You hear about it periodically in the news. Medicare rates are going to drop, and then, nope, they don't, because Congress gives us a month, and then another month, and then another month. And part of it's just basically political maneuvering on the part of Congress. They want to keep physicians sort of desperate to get that bit of legislation approved so that our incomes don't drop 20% for all our Medicare patients. And that, well, keeps us from talking about other things. And I think it's time for that strategy to go away. Now, this is all due to something called the Medicare Economic Index. Basically, this was the sustained growth rate formula. It was set up by Congress a long time ago, back I think in 2002, 2001. And the idea was if healthcare spending, or rather spending on Medicare for physician services, exceeds the growth of the gross domestic product, then Medicare is supposed to drop physician payments the next year to recoup the difference. Now, the problem, of course, is that it's really nice to peg something to the gross domestic product, but if the actual cost of doing business goes up faster than that, then the physicians effectively are looking at a pay cut even if the price remains static. And that has, in fact, been going on for about 10 years in medicine. So even though the cut is not made to reduce physician salaries, effectively there has been a decrement in what doctors make over the last decade. It can be particularly difficult in areas that are designated Area 99, Santa Cruz County, Santa Barbara County, because back in 1965, these were rural areas, and so as far as Medicare reimbursement is concerned, they're still rural areas. That makes no sense when these are parts of California that have some of the highest costs of living. And that means highest practice costs because, you know what, my employees have to pay their rent. Anyway, the Texas Medical Society has put a petition up. And between now and June 1st, they're trying to get 1 million signatures that basically say to Congress, please fix this. Right now, it's got about 80,000, so we've got a long way to go. And if you can see it in your heart to just ask Congress to please fix Medicare such that we don't have to keep coming up with this ridiculous game. Furthermore, if they ever let the hammer fall, it will be disastrous. Medical practices will close, particularly primary care practices. I mean, we really will close. When you're running a business and you're losing money, you can only do that for so long. And for many practices that are heavily Medicare dependent, they're just getting by right now. A 20% decrease in reimbursement would close the doors. And that's not going to help access. And it's going to cause a lot of doctors to just throw up their hands and retire. And we don't need primary care doctors retiring right now, folks. As we're in danger of actually improving the healthcare system and improving people's access, we really need those primary care doctors who are currently in practice to stay there. It's going to take a long time to bake new ones, I'll tell you. It's not something that you can make overnight. If you're in agreement, please go to the website of the Texas Medical Society, and we will put a link on our website, and sign this petition. Thank you very much. I think we'll start with an email. I had some really good emails this week. This one from Tim in Santa Cruz. Tim writes, Dear Dr. Motika, sorry, I'm just too old school to address you as Dr. Don. I would like to ask you about muscle testing as performed by a physician or other health practitioner. I'm skeptical, just as I am about the merits of homeopathy. My doctor performs muscle testing to gauge the effectiveness of various supplements, but I sometimes think that she is fake testing. That is, I think she might be really trying to plant a seed in my head that supplement X, for example, will benefit me better than supplement Y. The thing is, when I hold out my arm to offer resistance, with the other hand holding a particular supplement that the doctor is keen on, I feel that she is only pretending to press down hard to counter my resistance, though she does put a lot of body language into her act, if it is an act. I've not told the doctor of my reservations because there's an excellent chance that I'm dead wrong. Also, I don't want to tick off the healer. So what gives, Dr. Motika? Do you use muscle testing in your practice? Or is it just a parlor trick, something akin to the placebo effect? And thanks for your show. Well, Tim, I too am a confirmed skeptic on muscle testing or applied kinesiology. And every time I go to a functional medicine conference, I end up having this debate with people and challenging them to offer me a study, because it seems to me that this would be relatively easy to design and relatively cheap to do. It would be nice to prove benefit. You could do it just on the concept that a person has food allergies, okay? You could have tested the food allergies of an individual, so you know that they have a food allergy or food sensitivity. All right, nice scientific, you've got IgE against peanuts, okay? We can check your blood. Now, you don't know if the white box that I'm handing you has peanuts in it or not, and the person who is applying weight to your arm doesn't know. And we could use a device like a spring scale to measure how much force is being applied. We could just add weight to the arm by a blinded observer and see if a person did indeed have less strength in their arm holding peanuts versus holding walnuts when they're not allergic to one and they are allergic to the other. Just holding an arm and pushing down on it is a problem because it is notoriously difficult to measure strength. When I do neurologic testing on patients, it's basically really gross measurement. They can resist vigorously. If I work hard, I can push their arm down. They can hold their arm up against gravity. They can flick their arm or they can't move the thing at all. Five scales. This is not sufficiently nuanced for reliable repetitive testing. Plus, you run into the problem of muscle fatigue. The fourth time I test you, you're going to be weaker than the first time. So it's possible to game this. There's also suggestion. You know, I practice hypnotism with the permission of the patient, I want to admit. But what about hypnotizing people without their permission? That's called a placebo effect. It's pretty easy to suggest things to someone, and it could be done without the person being even aware that they're making the suggestion. So all in all, I reject muscle testing because I don't think it's sufficiently reliable. And I've never seen a study that would take out the unreliability aspects of it and demonstrate that there is, in fact, an effect. Let's just take a moment and play a thought game. If it were true, how would it work? Holding on to a bottle or a box with a supplement in it and having that affect your physiology. Well, it obviously couldn't be getting into your bloodstream, so it would have to be some kind of field phenomenon, some sort of energetic phenomenon. And yes, I do believe in field energy and it having an effect on the body. That's a lot of what acupuncture is about. Now, I was told once at an acupuncture conference about a study that demonstrated what would have to be a field phenomenon showing that people's pulses changed. And there are, of course, oscilloscopes and pressure meters that you can use to see a pulse on an oscilloscope. And so I'd love to find that study. And if anyone out there has a reference to it, please let me know, because unfortunately, while I've been told that it exists, the person who told me that didn't have a reference. If it's true, and there is something that demonstrates a field phenomenon, then as a good scientist, I'll have to take another look at applied kinesiology and muscle testing. My producer tells me that Wikipedia has a reference on it and is pretty much negative. Lots of chiropractic organizations do not support it. So, you know, those are people who do a lot of energetics. Kind of interesting that they would be against it. Makes me wonder a little bit more about it. So overall, I'd say be respectful to your healer and smile and nod, but don't necessarily buy your supplements from this person. And that's something else. I really think that when you sell supplements, you have an ethical obligation to provide those supplements either at a discount to your patient or give them information about where online or where in the marketplace they can obtain similar acceptable supplements. It's a little too, I think, damaging to your credibility as a healer. And also, I think it's against the ethics of the organization to just only tell people that the supplements that you have are exactly the ones for them and they can't get them anywhere else. Another good email this week from Anonymous in Santa Cruz wanting to know a diet for yeast infection. What is the diet for yeast infection? Is nutritional yeast okay or not? I'm assuming that when Anonymous sent this email, he or she was talking about the so-called Candida syndrome, which is a yeast Candida albicans growing in the intestine. Now, in my worldview, it is possible to have your health affected by having an overgrowth of Candida in your intestine. And I want to emphasize, I don't see this as just a problem with too much Candida. You also need to have impaired intestinal barrier, and you also probably have a disruption in all of your good flora because the Candida wouldn't be able to grow well and achieve a dominant situation in a healthy intestinal ecology. So I prefer the term dysbiosis, which just means the intestinal milieu is messed up. In that situation, there are definitely dietary practices that are helpful. And so we're going to talk about those. First of all, I really encourage the use of fermented foods. And these would be things like sauerkraut, kimchi, which is a Korean fermented cabbage, and yogurt. Something about fermented cabbage, it releases compounds. There's a lot of sulfur in it, which is good for detoxification. I also encourage people to consume live culture yogurt or kefir. These fermented foods are very beneficial, but they need to be consumed without the addition of a lot of sugar or starch. And that, and when I say sugar, I'm also including natural sources of sugar like honey or agave, because all of these are direct substrate for yeast, and you don't want necessarily to be giving them more food to grow on. In addition, I like the use of a contrary yeast. It's like fight bacteria with bacteria, fight yeast with yeast. And that's the Saccharomyces boulardii, which can be found in health food stores. It's widely available. There's even a product called FloraStore that I can order at my local hospital to be given to patients because it has scientific data showing that it helps with preventing antibiotic-related diarrhea, as do some of the other probiotics. So that's my answer to our anonymous caller. Avoiding starch and sugar, very limited alcohol, lots of fermented foods, and probiotics. We're going to Juan in Salinas. Hello, Juan, and welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Just to recall, I called you last week about my father-in-law, and he had an issue with his neck, and you know, I said that he'd hunch over and blah, 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 that even when he walks, it hurts, et cetera, et cetera. I got to tell you, as my kids that I teach to say, I've got to give you extreme props for your diagnosis. It was spot on. It's so spot on, it's scary.
Oh, that's great. I'm flattered.
He was taken to Stanford Medical, checked out by a neurologist. It turns out it is exactly the occipital nerve. They didn't do the occipital nerve blockage. They didn't need to. They could tell that's what it was. And apparently because he's got severe rheumatoid arthritis, something like that, the back of his head, you know, his bones are really brittle and they're kind of pressing on it. It was amazing. When I threw that at the neurologist, he said, so who told you? And I said, there's a doctor on the radio. He's like, who's that? Dr. Don Motika. I said, you're kidding. And I said, no. She said it over the phone. I guess I'll have to listen. It was so, again, the highest praise for you. I tell you, thank you very much.
Well, I understand I actually have a small fan club up at Stanford Medical School, so maybe I'll build my Stanford cred, you know? That's great. I'm very glad that I was correct. Obviously, that's reinforcing to the old ego. But also, it goes to show that sometimes if you just don't get too confused with the overlay that people come in with, which is all the past medical records and everything. Sometimes just taking a good history is all right. that it takes to build up a probability diagnosis.
Sorry,
no, I was going to say, a long time ago, one of my teachers said to me, "Dawn, common things are common and rare things are rare." So if you've got something, it's probably common. And if so, ask yourself what common thing could account for this syndrome.
You know, he went through six doctors until they referred him to Stanford. And you got it within 2 minutes. So I got to say, I want to know how I get on your list, how I become one of your patients.
Well, you just look me up in the phone book. Anyway.
Hey, doctor, thank you very much. I appreciate it. God bless you and doing what you do.
Well, thank you for the follow-up call.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Tanya in Santa Cruz. Hello, Tanya. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
I also was thinking I'm probably going to need to have a visit with you because the question is too big for a morning one-hour talk show. But I have atrial fibrillation, and I've had it since college. And I never had it in front of a doctor until 2006. And it's still very paroxysmal, but I'm getting a lot of rush from the medical profession to go on Coumadin or go on Plavix. I can't do any of those things because I have a bad gut from 10 years on Feldene a long time ago, or get an ablation up in Palo Alto. So I've been looking into the Hans R. Larsen method, and his book on preventing, what you want to do is prevent thrombosis and stroke.
Correct.
Because I'm practically asymptomatic with it on a beta blocker. And I can't find anything on this guy. He just sounds really rational, but his research is kind of old and the studies are small. So what do you know?
Well, actually, unless you tell me what we're talking about beyond the name of the person, I don't know anything. What does he recommend?
The naturopathic route, basically. He's got a list of 10 recommendations before you would ever get to an ablation.
Mm-hmm.
The arrhythmic drugs is one of them. I can't take any of those either. But he starts with basically fixing your diet. I mean, even down to going on the paleo diet if necessary, you know?
Right.
Not sleeping on your left side. And he recommends a bunch of supplements that are very much in sync with Life Extension Foundation recommendations for preventing the underlying causes of thrombosis. There are a lot of different ways that strokes happen, and Coumadin only blocks one of them, and it can also cause atherosclerosis and bone loss as it's preventing stroke. There are other ways, but they're not as well tested because there's no money for the drug companies in testing vitamin C and vitamin B and, you know, about 10 other vitamins. Now, that's the subject that maybe
sure.
I need to have a...
Well, let me just say that the idea that everyone needs to be on Coumadin, we'll come back and examine the science behind that in a second, and some of the alternative things that when people refuse to be on Coumadin, I recommend to them. But you need to understand the implications of the recommendation, okay? And this has to do with a concept called the medical standard of care, which is a one-size-fits-all set of recommendations based on studies that are done by institutions, not by drug companies, and not generally with Coumadin. None of the studies are sponsored by the company that makes Coumadin because that's an old drug. It's completely generic now. So it's a real genuine spirit of scientific inquiry. But because you have a relatively low frequency of stroke, and people who are in AFib constantly, not going in and out of it, have a stroke rate of maybe 2 or 3% a year. So think about how many people you would have to study and how long you would have to study them in order to see a big enough difference to get past just the statistical noise. And it's a lot of people over a lot of time. And what those studies show has to be subdivided based on, does the person also have cardiovascular disease? Do they also have gastrointestinal disease? And it gets too complicated way too quick for the law courts. And so what happens is everybody who does not want to get sued, which is every doctor in the country, feels compelled to recommend Coumadin to everybody. Certainly every cardiologist will recommend it to anyone who's in atrial fibrillation. And that's because they have to. they're not being a quote-unquote good cardiologist if they don't. Now, if you really step back and look at that critically, that's not necessarily a science-based appropriate recommendation for every single person. But I have a very low opinion of juries, and that's because we don't have a scientifically literate population. So a jury from that population is just going to zone out on any kind of nuanced discussion. And if I just parade six experts up who say, oh yeah, everybody needs to be on Coumadin to prevent a stroke, that's all it takes. I'm toast if I haven't recommended Coumadin and have it in my chart that I recommended Coumadin and that the patient had a informed refusal. So you listen, you smile, you say, no, thank you. I don't feel it's appropriate. I have this history of GI bleed. I'm concerned that I might have another one. I would rather try a natural route. I'm not in atrial fibrillation all the time. I hereby wave my magic wand and give you permission to refuse Coumadin.
I have that with my newest cardiologist.
Good. Now what you want to do is figure out, okay, if I'm not going to do that, what are the things that I should be doing? And you're right, there are lots of ways to affect coagulation, and there's lots of ways to affect atrial fibrillation. Now, there's a doctor who does, he calls it metabolic cardiology. His name is Steven Sinatra. He has a couple of popular books out. In those books, there are references that actually are studies that use the combination of L-carnitine, D-ribose, and CoQ10 in atrial fibrillation, particularly paroxysmal. There's also studies looking at taurine, which is an amino acid, not an essential amino acid, but high doses of taurine do stabilize the heart rhythm in lab animals. And I think there's some small studies in humans, but again, there's enough reason to do those things just on the basis of the current science that exists, and they will be at worst of no benefit, and at best, they'll help your heart. Oh, and also I want to add what you need to not take, which is you need to avoid cardiac stimulants. When you have AFib, you don't drink. When you have AFib, you don't smoke pot. When you have AFib, you don't do decongestants or caffeine, because all of these things are potential cardiac stimulants and you don't want to stimulate the atrial fib. So those are things you take away. Then what else would you add for the coagulation? Lots of data on natokinase from Japan for the improvement, the reduction of blood clotting.
Can I get a citation on that? Because he goes into that, Hans R. Larsen, but my doctor poo-poos it. He says there's no good study.
On what?
Natokinase.
Send me an email and I'll get it to you. I don't have that on the top of my head. I'll have to search for it. And it's Japanese literature, so all you're going to get is an abstract. There probably won't be a translated article.
But you like natokinase.
I recommend it for people with atrial fib if I think they're at risk. People who go into atrial fib briefly, say for 12 to 16 hours every now and then, there's no data that shows that you form a clot that quickly in your heart. So most of the research is if you're in atrial fib for more than 48 hours, and some studies say 24 hours, then you need to anticoagulate the person for a period of time. But they've looked at this because there are people who come in with their first episode of AFib and they get one shock of the heart and they're back in sinus rhythm. That's called cardioversion. And that can be done without Coumadin if you have only been in atrial fibrillation for a brief period of time. Again, in my local community, the doctors won't do that because they say, you can't prove to me that this person has only been in atrial fibrillation for 12 hours, even though I've got like a story that's just so persuasive. You know, I was running and I was fine, and then that afternoon, suddenly I could barely walk. To me, it's unlikely that that person was in atrial fib while they were running, but I can't prove that they weren't. And if the person had a stroke after they were cardioverted, that cardiologist is going down. He knows it, so he won't do the cardioversion. It's as simple as that. We have a lot of that kind of medicine in this country. I don't fault the doctors because I am scared of being sued too. It doesn't matter if I win the case, I lose. Because I lose time, I have enormous emotional anguish, I get called a lot of names, I get to deal with depositions, and the stress is enormous. And so if someone sues me, I lose, even if I win the case. And you have to understand that. It's just the case being brought is enough to do lots of damage to the person. So we're very avoidant of it. I want to mention fish oil because I'm going on it too late.
I do all the supplements I do about 40 supplements a day. I'm looking for somebody to tell me which ones I can drop.
Well, you can probably drop some. If you want to schedule an appointment up at my functional medicine office, I will go over that with you, but I won't do it here on the air.
That's what I thought, and that would be great. I'd love to see you in person. One last question.
Yes.
About the AFib?
Yeah.
This CHADS-2 thing seems very odd to me because my only comorbidity is a history of hypertension, but it's very well controlled at 120 over 70. And yet, he says, because I have a history of it, I get this point on the CHADS-2, which brings my stroke risk up to 8% annually. And my AFib has never lasted longer than an hour.
How old are you?
I'm 67.
Okay. So at 67 with hypertension, you've got narrowed small vessels. It's a good bet, even with a quote-unquote normal cholesterol. The reason that's important is it doesn't take as big a clot to give you a stroke.
Okay.
So it's based actually on just your risk of a stroke. It's how the question is asked. Remember, what can we measure as an endpoint? We can measure a stroke. And so if you look at what's a 67-year-old lady with hypertension stroke risk without AFib, it's not zero. If same 67-year-old lady has no hypertension, her stroke risk is probably half of the one with hypertension, even the controlled hypertension.
Uh-huh.
And so that's where that's coming from. It's probably legitimate to give you that point.
Yeah. And there's the possibility that my risk is up to 8%, even though I have no evidence of atherosclerosis.
And remember, it's
stress testing.
You don't get 8% of a stroke. You either get the stroke or you don't get the stroke. And so who gets 8% is several thousand 67-year-olds with hypertension compared to several thousand without hypertension. And so we are doing large groups of people who are all subtly different, and then we're assigning this number based on herd data. And then we're doing the thing that everybody does, which is a complete logical fallacy. We're taking that 8% and we're trying to apply it to a single individual who's going to have a binary event. We always do it, and it's actually not a legitimate transference of information. Just based on how statistics works, it doesn't really make sense, but it's the only way we can get our hands around any kind of rough quantification. But it does not have that kind of precision.
Yeah, that's what Larson would say, that I don't have a stroke risk because of an hour of atrial fibrillation a week. I have it because I'm a 67-year-old woman with a history of high blood pressure.
And I am in complete agreement with Hans Larson on
that.
So
what I need to do is all of the underlying causes of thrombosis, which means all the dietary things you've said, plus certain supplements. And I have other...
And I'm going to ask you to... We're going to move on now, okay? Because I think I have to give some other people a turn. But thank you very much for the call. And to wrap it up, yes, you need to do things that will thin your blood, and you need to avoid things that will thicken them.
Okay, and I'll get the Steven Sinatra book, and I'll make an appointment with you.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Our next question is an off-air question about the non-surgical treatments for gallstones, including liver flushes. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about gallstones. Gallstones are actually cholesterol balls. And cholesterol is a substance that normally stays in solution, kind of like salad dressing with oil droplets floating around in it. But it is capable of congealing into something that is more of a lump than a stone, although we do use the word stone. It's more of a grease ball than anything else. Gallstones come in really two sizes. The very large size gallstones are actually not too dangerous because they're too big to block the bile duct, and they'd usually just sit there in the gallbladder forever. Where you run into trouble is the smaller ones, which are perhaps the size of a pea or smaller than that. And these stones can actually get into the bile duct and block it. And they can block it at the level of the gallbladder, or they can block it such that even the pancreatic secretions aren't able to drain into the duodenum. Now, if that second one happens, you get pancreatitis, which is not pretty. And often people will come in with what's called gallstone pancreatitis as a cause. And in that case, it's really important to remove the stone, fish it out of there so that the pancreatitis can resolve. And a recent study just came out that demonstrated that early surgery is actually better than delayed surgery. But I digress. So given that it's a coagulation, is there anything you can do to dissolve it? And the answer is actually yes. There is a bile salt that comes from bear gallbladders that is a very, very effective solvent for gallstones. It's called ursodiol, and it's actually available as a pharmaceutical. It's used in pregnant women who shouldn't undergo gallbladder surgery late in their pregnancy. It's used in people who are frail and elderly and aren't really candidates for a gallbladder surgery or can't tolerate the anesthesia. And it could probably be used in a larger group of people, but that use is limited by the fact that it causes a lot of GI upsets. So it's not the easiest drug in the world to take. And it's kind of an orphan drug in the sense that it's not widely used, so it's expensive. All that being said, that's one way. And there's a great deal in the alternative world about drinking lots of olive oil and drinking apple cider and doing this on a regular basis, and that this will flush out the gallbladder and shrink the stones. And I've heard lots of anecdotal stuff. I've never seen any kind of published study where they measured the stones, did this, and then showed that they had shrunk. There might be something out there. There's probably a case report or two. But because this is a dynamic situation, I don't necessarily worry that anybody's going to hurt themselves with a liver flush or doing the lots of olive oil and apple cider vinegar. But I don't generally myself put a lot of faith in that in terms of gallstones. The other thing to remember is that we have to classify gallstones as incidental or symptomatic. If a person has symptomatic gallstones with gallbladder attacks, you put them on a low-fat diet, try to get them to lose some weight. If they are still having attacks, then yes, I think they need their gallbladder removed. I do think that's an appropriate standard of care. If they want to go on a liver flush and do the olive oil and apple cider and whatever other herbs, I think rosemary is in there in some of the recipes, and they're successful and they stop having gallbladder attacks, well, I'm less worried about them because I don't necessarily feel that asymptomatic gallstones are an indication for surgery. My producer, Charlie, tells me that ursodiol is now mostly synthesized and not derived from bears, which is good because just like the horrific things that were done to pregnant horses to produce Premarin, apparently horrific things are done to bears to get their bile salts, which when I stop and think about it, yeah, collecting bile salts would be a rather difficult thing to do. They probably stick a catheter in through the bear's abdomen and collect it externally, and that can't feel good for the bear. So it's important, if you do use a product like that, to try and use the product that doesn't inflict harm on any living thing. So a synthesized version would be most appropriate there. So one thing that is really important in our healthcare debate here is the appropriateness of various therapies. And now that we have all of these different things going on, people are actually starting to say, you know, we look at what the Europeans are doing. They're doing something really different than what we're doing. Who's right? And it's a movement in medicine called evidence-based medicine, where things are actually examined with a critical eye. And what's been very interesting is that often people don't do things because they're scientifically validated in medicine. They pretend that they're scientifically validated, but a lot of what we do is actually done because that's what they taught us in our training. Now, here's an interesting study looking at surgery for lumbar spinal stenosis. When I was in my medical training, I was taught that if someone had pressure on the nerves of their back from a disc that was causing radicular pain, that is pain in the nerve root, with weakness, that surgery was superior to conservative care. I was also taught by my rather conservative orthopedic teachers that if the symptoms were radicular pain only, that conservative care and surgery had equivalent outcomes, and therefore conservative care, which didn't involve operations and pain associated with cutting into the back, was superior. That has been validated scientifically. But something interesting has happened. And in this study, investigators looked at the dates from 2002 and 2007. And the rate of surgery in Medicare patients for lumbar stenosis was completely stable during that period. But in 2002, less than 1% of people who had surgical decompression of a nerve root were treated by a so-called complex fusion. In other words, bone graft augmentation, little screws or pins or bolts or other things to quote-unquote stabilize the spine. In 2002, it was only 1%, less than 1% of all of such procedures. By 2007, it had grown to 15%. And it's rather unlikely that there's been a big difference in how lumbar spinal stenosis presents or in the basic pathology of this disease between 2002 and 2007. What has happened, however, is a change in the reimbursement rates, such that if a physician does a simple decompression, they'll get X as a fee. If they do one of these complex instrumentations or use implants, their fee is 10 times greater. That was a change that occurred in the fee schedule in the early 2000s. So as a result of new technology and a change in the fee schedule, suddenly a whole bunch more people need the more complicated surgery. Now, if the more complicated surgery was just more expensive, that would be not okay, but it wouldn't be reprehensible. On the other hand, the complication rate of the more complex surgery is double, with twice as many dying and twice as many having major surgical complications. So when we do something like this that demonstrates that the fee schedule drives the surgery complexity, and we know that the surgery complexity increases the complication rate and therefore the cost per case, both in terms of finances and also in terms of human suffering, you got to step back and ask yourself, how do we stop that? So this is a little bit of science pointing out the need to manipulate the fee schedule such that you don't create perverse incentives like this very obvious situation. We're going to go to a caller. It's Celia in Santa Cruz. Hello, Celia. Welcome to the program.
Hi. This is a follow-up about the gallstones. I had two gallstone attacks last fall. They were a week apart. And I haven't had anything since. Doctor recommended surgery, did say it was voluntary. I declined. He said it was unusual but not a crazy idea. And after the second gallbladder attack, I ate as much fat as I could to see if I could trigger another one, and nothing happened. You know, listening to your show, and you said there was a recent study that showed early surgery was better.
In pancreatitis.
Oh, in pancreatitis, okay.
Just in people who are hospitalized for gallstone pancreatitis.
Okay.
So that's a very specific group, very much a minority.
Okay. So the other thing that he said was I shouldn't go visiting a third world country for like more than 3 weeks without having my gallbladder removed.
I usually tell people I wouldn't use the third world country anymore. And the reason I say that is that most of the third world now is doing a fabulous business in surgery. You know, so people go, you know, they fly to Thailand to get their gallbladder removed because it's so much cheaper if they have to pay. So just about every third world country that's a vacation destination has one of these boutique hospitals. Now, if we're talking Peace Corps and you're going to, you know, the uninhabited part of the Ivory Coast, or you're going out to African villages where it's...
That's kind of what I do.
Yeah. If that's what you do, then I give this advice to people who choose not to have their hernia surgery either, because it's kind of like you should be within 12 hours of an emergency room.
Okay.
And if you're going out to where you can't be evacuated, there's no phones, you'd have to get into the van and ride over, you know, 12 hours of bumpy roads to get to the airstrip where they could radio for an evacuation, then yeah, they used to take people's appendixes out just prophylactically for that indication, because you don't want to die because you get gangrene of the gallbladder because you get an attack in the wrong place.
Yeah.
But very few people actually have that as a reason to do a prophylactic surgery. You might be one of them, but very few people do.
Okay. So two gallbladder attacks and then nothing. You know, to me, it kind of seems like a non-issue at this point.
Well, it depends on whether you're planning to go off and, you know, help dig wells in Gabon or something. But
if as long, I tell the same thing, you know, don't go backpacking into the Mojave for 3 weeks, you know, don't go out of cell phone access where, you know, you can't be expecting help for a long time because you're in the wilderness.
Well, that's kind of a great rule of thumb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
12 hours to the nearest ER.
Okay, thank you.
All right, good luck.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Another bit of off-air commentary, we had a caller who wanted to know about whether I approved of the use of traction or gravity devices like gravity boots or things where you hang upside down to decompress vertebrae and discs. And yes, I think those are good devices. I like the reclining platforms where you'll hook yourself into a kind of an ankle device and then flip the whole table upside down or at a 45-degree angle. Gravity is wonderful. I also will recommend the use of cervical traction devices. And yes, I know sometimes there have been lawsuits against the people who prescribe these or against the people who manufacture them because there's been an untoward event. I do think they're substantially safe, but nothing's 100% safe. I think that I am selective about who I suggest those to because you need to have a helper. You should never be doing these things at home alone because you could get stuck. Somebody needs to be there who can help you get in and out of the device safely. That being said, I think that they can be very beneficial and help people get through the acute flares of pain and avoid surgery, which I don't think should be done as often as it is done. Interesting bit of research that came out just last month about venous thromboembolism and hormone replacement therapy. So I wanted to be sure to get this one in the show today. And that is that women who use estrogens, if you use a patch or a cream or a gel, you do not have an increased risk of blood clots in the lungs or in the legs. So this was a very important piece of research because we thought this would be true, but we hadn't the data up until now to really say so. The way this works is when you take the estrogen orally, about 90% of it goes through the liver and is deactivated immediately. In the course of that deactivation, there's an alteration in the blood clotting proteins, including something called plasminogen activator inhibitor. And this leads to an increase in the tendency for the blood to clot and the observed equivalence of risk that's seen pre and post menopause. So let's be clear. If you're female and you're in your fertile years, you've got a lot of estrogen, your blood likes to clot. That's good. If you're giving birth, you want your blood to clot. It is a risk that goes up with age in everybody, males and females, as we start to develop irregularities on the insides of our blood vessels. But in women who are going through menopause, let's say at the age of 45 and using estrogen, their risk is, let's say, from 45 to 55, the same as a woman who is making her own estrogen between 45 and 55 because she goes through a late menopause. So the estrogens that are given orally don't increase the risk against the background. It's just that as women get older, the natural tendency is for the estrogen to evaporate by the time they're 55 or 60, and therefore their risk of blood clots drops considerably unless they're taking estrogen supplementation orally. And what we can now say is that for women who choose to continue with estrogen supplementation, the use of a patch or a cream does not increase their risk of blood clots. And that's very, very interesting and important information. Let's go to Anna in SoCal. Hello, Anna, and welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call. You had talked with one of the callers about an alternative to surgery for gallstones, a way of dissolving them. What about kidney stones?
Well, kidney stones are soluble in water. The problem is that once they form, they block the passageway. And so they need to be, hopefully, are able to be passed naturally. And the body has a mechanism for doing this. If they're too big to pass, they can be pulverized by a lithotripsy device, which is a really good thing. And that turns them into powder. And then the powder just kind of sifts out through the urinary system and eventually is peed out.
Mm-hmm.
What we want to do subsequent to that is keep the fluid level high enough that all of the dissolved solutes in the blood remain dissolved and don't precipitate out. And that is why people who have had a kidney stone are told to drink lots of fluids and avoid dehydration. If you know what the kidney stone is, and this is very important, if you are passing a stone, to save the stone and to pee through a filter, like a coffee filter if you don't have a technical urine filter. But what you're trying to do is collect the salt so that you know what dietary component to avoid. There are uric acid stones, and there are calcium carbonate stones, and there are calcium oxalate stones. And depending upon which one it is, there are different dietary suggestions. For example, people who have uric acid stones need to avoid vitamin C because it can cause the uric acid to come out of solution. People who have calcium oxalate stones need to avoid greens that contain a lot of oxalic acid, or if they do consume such foods, they need to be very high in their hydration so that their body is able to eliminate it.
Yeah, I have a couple of small kidney stones and they're not doing anything. I haven't had any pain.
How do you know they're there?
Oh, from a CT scan.
Ah, okay. And that was found because the CT scan was done for something else, and,
yes,
and there they were.
Yes.
So those are stones that are nephrocalcifications. Those are calcium in the kidney. They may or may not ever actually get into the drainage system,
right,
and cause a blockage.
Okay.
So lots of fluids, and over time they may shrink or they may not.
Yeah, so which, one lives in hope.
Well, no, one lives with the knowledge that sooner or later the sword is going to fall in one way or another. And the best thing to do is put it out of your mind and live as fully and healthily as possible.
Okay.
It would never be recommended that anyone go after those stones surgically.
Right.
That would be completely inappropriate.
You
only go after a kidney stone.
But just keep drinking lots of fluid.
That's right. Don't get dehydrated.
Okay.
Because they can get larger.
Yes.
And they can act like seeds, like seed crystals, essentially. And any available thing that wants to come out of solution in your bloodstream will tend to attach to those kidney stones.
Yeah.
So they almost act as a catcher's mitt for anything that's sort of tippy and right on the border of wanting to crystallize. So you don't want anything ready to crystallize.
All right.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. An off-air question about my opinion of the use of L-arginine and L-citrulline supplements for arterial cleansing and raising nitric oxide. And the caller referred to the research by Dr. Ignaro at UCLA. I have not personally read Dr. Ignaro's papers, but the concept of using L-arginine to raise nitric oxide is a very well-established principle, and there is ample data to show that it does in fact work. And it's one of my mainstays when I'm trying to treat early hypertension or pre-hypertension. So a good example might be a fellow comes into my office, maybe he wants a Viagra prescription. I put him on his treadmill, he's okay, but when he's apprehensive, his blood pressure's high in my office, so I give him a cuff, and lo and behold, when he's home and relaxed, his pressures are great. When he comes into the office or drives in traffic, his pressures go up. That's quote-unquote white coat hypertension, which I think is an actual disease. The current thing in medicine is, oh, we don't have to treat that, that's an artifact. I kind of disagree with that. My opinion is it's a pre-disease. It's a warning sign that the arteries aren't relaxing properly when there's an adrenaline flush through the system. And what that means is the nitric oxide isn't working right, which means the endothelial cells are getting sick, which means lower the cholesterol, increase the antioxidants in the diet, and put the people on L-arginine, which is an amino acid, about 3 or 4 grams a day, spread out through the day, will, in some individuals at least, raise their nitric oxide levels enough to eliminate the white coat hypertension. So that's a first-line kind of therapy approach to the natural management of high blood pressure. And I'll be the first to admit, it doesn't work in everybody. My next step, just to share protocol, I'll often add spironolactone and magnesium. Spironolactone's a diuretic, so I'm quote-unquote legal with the recommendations. It's a diuretic that's been shown to be more effective than the hydrochlorothiazide group for the management of hypertension, so it's become my go-to diuretic for that. And I love high doses of magnesium, whatever I can get the person to take without having diarrhea. And those things are often enough to get the blood pressure down, at least for a while, and then it's the lifestyle. Get out and exercise, lose a few pounds. If people take the elevated blood pressure as a wake-up call and don't just say, okay, well, now I have to take a pill, I'm just getting older. It's like, yeah, you are, but you don't necessarily have to take that lying down. You should take it standing up on a treadmill. That's the best approach to aging, is to exercise every day once you retire, because now you really can and you don't have an excuse. Well, we've come to the end of another hour. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have, and I hope you'll come back next week for more Ask Dr. Don. Next week, we're going to have an interview. I'll be off at a functional medicine conference gathering lots of interesting information for you. You'll hear it here first on Ask Dr. Don. Until then, so long and stay healthy.